Good morning and welcome to Countrywide. On this week's programme, the starting gun is fired on the next round of EU farm subsidies. What is proposed? It's feast time on a farm in Donegal, and we hear about the old tradition of Frocken Sunday as we enter the harvest season. Well, we're on 51551, or you can email countrywide@rte.ie. It's great to be with you again. Well, listen, for over five decades, the EU budget was, roughly enough, divided into thirds. It was a third for farmers, a third for poorer regions, and a third for all the rest. But things are now changing if the new proposals put forward last week are anything to go by. The proposed budget, which is for 2028 to 2034, is the biggest ever at an eye-watering €2 trillion. That's trillion euro. But when it comes to the common agricultural policy part of it, well, estimates suggest cuts of 15 to 25% on current levels. We're going to hear more about what's in these proposals shortly. But one thing the Commission is determined to do is to use the budget to support younger farmers, particularly women. And they are, to put it mildly, a very rare breed in Ireland. Well, Sophie Bell is 26 years old and she farms 59 acres just outside Virginia in Cavan. She studied agriculture at Harper Adams University in the UK and then returned home and 2 years ago went into partnership with her father. And the farm will eventually be hers. I called in to her during the week just as she was feeding some of the young dairy heifers she contract rears.
They're all very content. So we're kind of in the middle of the farm at the moment. This would be the main silage field. In front of us is tilled ground. We have ploughed it. It was ploughed by a 92-year-old farmer down the road.
He ploughed it for you?
Yes, yeah. It's James Brady. He did it for us.
And do you think he did a good job?
He did, yeah. He did. He's got a lot of patience. And it's just been harrowed today, so... We'll probably start picking stones. There's plenty in front of us, so yeah. And then eventually we'll get round to sowing the seed and hopefully it'll look like the rest of the field behind us.
Can you get locals to help? Is there a bit of a mehel that you can get going here?
It's sad. Looking back on old photos, everyone used to always chip in and help out, but it seems that I think farming has become a lot more individual now and we're a lot more mechanized. So yeah, there's less of a community, I guess, to help out. I think back in the day, everyone came out and helped with harvest and making hay, and there was always a picnic basket afterwards and everything like that. Yeah.
Where are all the young people your age around here? Where have they gone?
A lot of them have emigrated. A lot of the young farmers have full-time jobs during the day. And I think by the time you get to the end of the week, you're kind of burnt out and you have so many jobs to catch up on the farm. So it's very hard for young people to see each other, I think, especially as farmers. Once one job is finished, you're onto another one.
Why have they emigrated?
I think they're just fed up. It's hard to get or make a living here. It's hard for us to see a future in terms of housing and various things like that. For now, they're just making the most of a bad situation, and some might come back, but yeah, a lot of them seem happy where they are.
Mainly in Australia?
Yeah. Australia, I think, is the main place that everyone has gone to, or either Canada as well. Like last summer, for example, there was at least one person every week that I knew were going. So, yeah, it's crazy.
And you're standing on your beautiful farm. So I imagine the answer to this is because I have a beautiful farm. But is there any reason why you haven't emigrated?
I think the farm is the main draw. I would like to travel and go away, but not in a big, long period. But yeah, I think it's just because, mainly because I'm a homebody, that I haven't gone yet.
To say you're a rare breed is to put it mildly. You know, a young farmer, a woman, and you have a certain degree of control also and ownership over the farm. But what are your plans and hopes?
I don't want it to go any bigger. I don't want it to expand in terms of acres. One main reason, because land is so hard to get at the moment and so expensive, it's not accessible at the moment. What I'd love is to have it in a safe place financially, have great infrastructure in the yard, which is in process, and for it just to be easily managed and reduce any physical hardships, so that it's not tough on the body, and just have it really well structured. I think that's what success on the farm looks like to me, and making sure that all the animals are happy and healthy as well.
Would you hope to be able to go full-time farming?
It's very hard to see a future, but I would love to. I think it would bring real contentment and satisfaction to the job, because at the moment it's so much strain to just keep it, all the plates turning. Everything has grown really expensive, and I think in terms of our own income, it's hard to actually sustain a living because of the price of our own livelihoods. It's very hard to sustain both, never mind the farm. Yeah.
Yeah. Last week, the Common Agricultural Policy was being discussed, because the EU budget from 2028 is going to be agreed over the next 2 years. Here are you on the ground in Cavan. You are what the Commission want more of: young female farmers. What do you make of it all?
We need to, at first, look after our farmers, no matter what age they are. They need to be heard. They need to be looked after and kept where they are. We can't lose any more. However, I think for our young farmers, and especially new entrants and young women, we really need to integrate a lot more for them to make it more accessible, because at the moment it really isn't. It's very, very difficult to land on your own feet and get into the industry. It takes a lot of resilience, takes a lot of determination, and it can often lead to a lot of burnout. There are barriers there that we face that go unnoticed. For example, on my farm, the tractor, I can't do certain things with it because it's built for someone who isn't my height. So there's certain barriers there that need to be thought about, and maybe introduce grants to help with that. Or maybe if there's any physical limitations that we may have, there's machinery there to help us, but we can't get access to it. Because, for example, we're a small farm, it's quite difficult to afford certain machinery.
Is there one thing that you would like to get out of the cap?
Just some thought into the pressure that we face. Like, we are working so much, and it's so hard to catch a breath and just be a young person. I think, like, it's so hard to just take our minds off everything and leave the house and actually socialise or do something off farm. Just a lot more support for young people would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah. And this is mainly because young people like yourself and others that you know have a full-time job because the farm isn't paying, and then you're coming home in your evenings, on your weekends, and you're working on the farm all the spare hours, and you're wrecked.
Yeah, yeah. Have to wear a really good concealer. Yeah, it's hard to put into perspective the pressure, the constant flow of work that's always happening. It's hard to put that into words. But yeah, I never really imagined this when I was first going out into the industry, how tough it could be. Yeah. Yeah.
It is hard to see a future. Sophie Bell there on her farm in Cavan, giving a very honest view of the pressures faced by young farmers like herself. Well, crafting a budget for 27 countries stretching from Lapland to Lisbon is a fiddly process. So said The Economist last week. Well, fiddly is one way to describe it. There are many competing demands for the pot of money, and member states like Ireland are not able or willing to contribute any more. We're going to be discussing what is proposed, and I'm delighted to say I'm joined here this morning by farmer Dennis Drennan, president of the Irish Creamery Milk Suppliers Association, which represents farmers by lobbying at local, national and EU level. Karen Mannion, head of Forum Connemara, which is a local development company which delivers programmes on behalf of government departments, including the Rural Development Programme Leader, and in Galway by Ruth Hegarty, director of Food Policy Ireland, and a board member of Tullive Bio, a farm organisation which lobbies for healthy, affordable local food. Good morning, Ruth. Good morning, Karen. And good morning, Dennis. Before we speak, we want to have an overview of what is in the new proposals. So I spoke earlier with Bartosz Brzezinski, the Brussels reporter for the global news organisation Politico. And I asked him to explain the wider financial pressures facing the EU, beginning with the Ukraine war.
We have a war just across the border in Ukraine, still raging on. We have still kind of reverberating impacts of what COVID has done to the economy. We have challenges like Donald Trump in the White House and the pressure he's been putting on trade partners across the world, not just Europe. Actors like China that is growing in influence. We now have priorities such as defense, competitiveness that have come to the fore for European politicians, for heads of governments, heads of states, and for heads of the European Union.
Can you talk a little bit about the size of the budget? The current one that we're in is about 1.2 trillion euro, and it's made up of contributions from member states of in and around 1% of gross national income. How big is the new proposed budget?
The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, when she unveiled this new budget, she announced this headline figure of 2 trillion euro, which on paper sounds significantly bigger than the current budget that runs until 2027, which is 1.2 trillion euros. However, one has to account for inflation that eats into the value of money. So there is also a bit of a caveat to the current EU budget because we had COVID. And so the EU borrowed around 600 billion euro, and this money needs to be paid off. The pot of money isn't really growing, but the demands for what to do with this money are.
Can we go through the top line proposals when it comes to the common agricultural policy portion of the budget? What are the key changes?
So the key change is that the European Commission attempted to make it more targeted. And so the headline idea here is that the European Commission wants to target it towards farmers who actively contribute to food production, who actively produce goods that are sold in the market. It's about rewarding farmers who are actively farming. So not so much hobbyists, not so much people who have a side gig running a farm. We also have more targeted measures towards young farmers, some measures for female farmers. So there's an attempt to spend this money on a more limited amount of farmers, but actually in the Commission's language, farmers who actively farm. The big focus of this common agricultural policy is to make farming attractive for newcomers, young farmers, those who might inherit a farm or those who might purchase a farm. And that's where we see this cutoff for people over 65 years old. But essentially, the headline message from the Commission coming out is don't look at the money being shrinking. Focus on the fact that we are doing this to ensure that farming remains an attractive economic activity.
And the other thing that they have suggested is to limit the maximum amount a farmer can receive to 100,000 euro.
That is an attempt that the Commission has been trying time and again. Big industrialized farms that can survive well without this public money are still benefiting from it and are still receiving it. And so there's a bit of a criticism where there are farmers who need it but don't receive enough of it. And there are farmers who are big enough and don't need it, who do receive the lion's share of it. And so the Commission is trying to create this idea of fairness.
I mean, the cap has been going since 1962, but in 2000, it saw a huge big change when the budget was effectively split between Pillar 1, which are direct payments to farmers, and market measures like intervention, all of that paid using EU money. And then Pillar 2, which was for rural development, agri-environment schemes. This pillar was co-financed between the EU and the member state, in our case, obviously, Ireland. What they are now proposing is to fold these together into one pot. What is the thinking behind this?
Well, this was a big fight inside the commission leading up to this proposal. People in charge of the budget saying, wait a minute, this second pillar, rural development, actually still goes to the pockets of farmers. On paper, it suggests that a lot of this money is supposed to go to developing the rural communities, but in reality, it was going as top-ups to farmers. And so there was this idea to just get rid of it. But then there was pushback from the agricultural side. And so Agriculture Commissioner Christoph Hansen fought hard. And by the end, what the compromise that they've agreed on is to basically scrap the two-pillar structure, put a lot of that rural development money, that pillar two money, back into the pillar one. Commission officials are adamant. Forget the two-pillar structure. Forget the disappearance of the second pillar. Now there is no pillar one, pillar two. There's just a single common agricultural policy with money that can be co-financed by national governments. The argument is, don't also look at the amount of this budget, because that is just the minimum. That is just the floor.
It's hard not to be suspicious about the fact that really what this might be about is helping to divert farmers' anger away from Brussels as the problem and towards, in our case, Dublin as the problem. Because if the member states have more control over how they spend the money, more control over how they're shaping the payments, then they're the ones that the farmers can be angry with if things go wrong.
And that's kind of, yes, that's in Brussels, the protests that we saw a year ago, they still resonate inside the commission, directing their anger at Ursula von der Leyen, directing their anger at these nameless EU officials. Whereas now the argument can be, well, talk to your agriculture minister. He's the one who's deciding how much money you'll receive. And so direct your anger there.
And speaking of farmers' anger, I mean, your reporting includes the leader of the Copa Gujeka group, the farm lobby, said this proposal is a declaration of war. How has the farm lobby responded to the proposals, and what is their thinking behind their opposition?
Well, they've taken it as a slap in the face leading up to the European elections of June 2024. Farmers were put on a pedestal. Ursula von der Leyen in her speeches highlighted the strategic role that farmers play in providing food security for the European continent, how they feed Europe under a threat of war. And what farmers now feel they've received is a smaller share of money. For many farm lobbies in Brussels, the common agricultural policy dating back to the early 1960s is an essential element of the European project. And any attempt to touch that money, any attempt to restructure that money without consent from those groups is treated, as the leader of Copa Gujeka said, a declaration of war.
And how do you see these proposals from the point of view of the non-farming general public who pay into this pot of money, who want healthy, affordable food? We've seen massive food inflation in the last few years. Are they going to solve some of those big problems or not?
Right now, there is no sign of any thought behind that. It seems like a much bigger thought on the European Commission's mind was, let's preserve as much of that money as possible, given the pressures. Let's worry about what to do with that money later. For the past 5 years, there was a lot of talk in Brussels about the need to move to healthier diets, given the health challenges. Now the mantra seems to be, let's maintain as much of the status quo as possible.
Bartosz Brzezinski of Politico there with a bit of an overview of the proposals. 51551 for your texts. Dennis Drennan, you heard there the head of Copa Gujeka saying it's a declaration of war. Do you feel the same way?
Well, look at it, and I suppose we're at the early stages of the negotiations of the cap budget, but we're starting from a very poor position where the overall budget has been cut by 22.5%. And, you know, where Karen would be batting for pillar two and I'll be batting for pillar one, but there was a time I was chair of a leader company too, and I understand Karen's plight. But I suppose no matter which side of pillar one or pillar two you're on, if you've a 22.5% cut to the overall budget, and, you know, we also have to consider the size that Europe is now versus where it was, we'll say, 20 years ago, like, it's a lot less butter to be spread on a lot more bread. So it's going to be more thinly spread and it's going to be less for everybody here. And that is the main problem.
But do you accept that the pressures on the budget? I mean, it's Ukraine war, it's COVID deaths, it is competitiveness in Europe, it is the threat of Trump's tariffs, China. There's a lot of things coming at Europe. And the reality is, as member states,
Some of them are broke, like France and Italy. Other ones are just saying, we're not going to pay any more. So there is a cake. It needs to be divided. The cake isn't necessarily getting any bigger.
Yeah, but I suppose the one thing that we all need is food three times a day, and it's part of living. And I mean, if we do, there's a demand there from the consumer for sustainably produced, safe, traceable, environmentally friendly food, and that needs to be produced. I mean, if you go back to the origins of CAP, it was all about a food policy. Like, if you look at, you know, Europe starved during and after the Second World War, and that's where the whole CAP budget came from. It was to secure food security for Europe, and we're actually rapidly heading towards not having that food security anymore, because if we look at, listen to Sophie there earlier on the programme, the number of young people who want to enter the sector is just dwindling, and we've hit our lowest level ever here in Ireland. And if we can't provide an income for farmers that is comparable to other sectors, we're not going to have farmers.
Karen, can you talk a little bit about your use of CAP money? I mean, we often think of CAP as just being a farm payment, but it's a massive funder of rural development, and your company takes in that money and then delivers certain schemes. Can you talk a little bit about what the schemes are?
Yeah, so Ella, you know, Leader over the past, you know, nearly 35 years has played such a strong part of CAP. And, you know, Leader funding, yes, it's grant funding, but it's also funds the core of our our local development company, of Forum Connemara. And quite frankly, if we didn't have that Leader funding, you know, we couldn't continue. And then, you know, that has a knock-on effect, obviously, on other programmes like the Rural Social Scheme, like the Rural Recreation Programme. EIPs, for example.
European Innovation Projects.
That's correct, yeah. Horizon funding, life programmes that local development companies like ourselves operate. So it really is the core, you know, part of it. I mean, the Leader philosophy is about, it's a methodology in terms of, you know, guiding, coaching, supporting, building resilience. And Sophie, you know, mentioned that particular word there. And like some of the activities we're involved in would be, you know, diversification, you know, farm diversification, agritourism, you know, the food sector, adding value, you know, for example, Leader funding towards, you know, ice cream makers or, you know, cheese producers or whatever, adding value. And we're also involved in the likes of the bioeconomy, you know, the circular economy. So in Forum Connemara, we're involved in a wool project, you know, in terms of adding value to wool and giving, you know, other avenues for that product to be utilised. We're involved in heritage projects. For example, we're working at the moment with Fulch Ireland on the Beara Breffni Way, which is the longest long distance walking route in Ireland. So that follows Donal Cam O'Sullivan in 1603. He was one of the last great chieftains, and he took a trip from West Cork up to Cavan, you know, so go, you know, right through the country.
So the core of the funding is coming your way. You're then disseminating it and funding these schemes. The Commission are going to roll, according to these proposals, if they get through, they want to roll Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 into one fund. How does that sound to you?
Well, look, you know, I suppose we, you know, we want to fight for, you know, the retention of the Leader programme. We are quite worried, to be fair, that it isn't really mentioned. You know what I mean? You know, I mean, you know, we're talking about direct payments to farmers a lot. Our funding in Leader, well, so far, hasn't been ring-fenced.
So you would you be concerned? I mean, in essence, what it means is, without wanting to cause a lack of harmony this morning, in essence, it means that yourself and Dennis will be going for the same pot of money.
But we are the same people. You know what I mean? There isn't a them and us situation. Because, for example, you know, farming organisations are on our Leader boards. We're partnership companies. So we are the same people. For example, Sophie mentioned there, you know, her comrade or her, you know, school friends or whatever, people her age are heading off to Australia or emigrating, etc. What can we offer? What can we offer Sophie in terms of opportunities, you know, to be like her cohort, you know, the areas of transport, opportunities for social, you know, for social activities? We have to have a strong economy. We have to support young people like Sophie in terms of training, upskilling, resilience. Okay. That all ties in to what Dennis is talking about. You know, so from my viewpoint, there isn't a them and us. We're all together. And as always, we have to work together really, really hard to to get the best that we can, and certainly our member state, Ireland, has to fight with us on that around co-funding. And ring fencing, really, I suppose, at the moment, Ella, this uncertainty is worrying. And we would try and fight for that.
Ruth Hegarty, I want to bring you in there from Galway. I suppose, to a certain extent, Ruth, it's easy to forget two things at the heart of the CAP. It's funded using public money. And at the end, the result of what farmers do, which is mainly food production, it's eaten by all of us. It's bought by all of us. You were a board member of Talamh Beo. You lobby for more access to healthy, affordable local food. What, if anything, do these proposals deliver for your agenda?
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, one of the things that I think a lot, most people probably welcome is the degress of areas-based payments and, you know, the capping of payments at 100,000. So I think moving away from where we are, that, you know, at the moment where maybe extremely wealthy landowners are getting huge checks from Europe, and, you know, the signalling that there's going to be additional support for priority groups, including young and new entrants and women farmers. And generational renewal is absolutely vital to the future of farming. So that's really important. And they've also indicated that there might be you know, additional support for small farms and mixed farms. So we're still seeing this obviously area-based approach, which is essentially still about scale. I think what we need is to move more fully towards a model where we're rewarding farmers for delivering public goods, you know, delivering for climate and nature, but also for public health, as Bartosz mentioned, which is often left out of the discussion. And, you know, it is worrying that there does appear to be a move away from conditionality in these CAP proposals where, you know, payments are linked to good farming practices and good environmental practices. So overall, it's definitely a worrying trajectory in terms of, you know, the lack of ring fencing of funding for agri-environment schemes and rural development, and those having to kind of compete in this one big pot of funding. But as you said, Ella, you know, this is something that every member state is contributing to. You know, the CAP is a huge a huge budget that taxpayers are contributing to, and, you know, the response kind of from Copacajeca, you know, that this was kind of a call to arms, is like this kind of attitude is always there, that the CAP budget is for farmers and for, you know, the agricultural industry. And of course we have to protect farmer livelihoods. That's absolutely essential. You know, as Dena said, they deliver on food security, and, you know, we need people to continue to go into farming and produce food for all of us. But agriculture and food has to deliver for everyone. You know, it has to deliver for health, climate, nature and society. We're all stakeholders in it. So I think that we kind of need to move away from this idea that the CAP is, you know, just about, you know, being protected as a payment, you know, for farmers, and that we really need to move towards a much more integrated and holistic policy around food and farming.
Dennis.
Yeah, I think, look, if we look at where CAP came from, it really was a partnership between society and agriculture. And the society's part was, I suppose, that it provided funding to ensure food security. And the farmers' end of that was that it was for farmer support, but for environmental protection, rural development, you know, and the supply of high quality, nutritious, healthy, environmentally friendly food to the consumer. And I think if the CAP budget is decimated like it has been, like we're looking at the CAP budget that was 70% of this total pot of money back in 1980, and it's now less than 25%.
I mean, it's going down one way, which is a downward trajectory. 1980.
Yeah, yeah, but and the issue is the number of farmers is also going down in that downward trajectory. So we have a choice, like either society wants to support farming through CAP, or we're going to see a future escalation of what we're seeing on ourselves at the moment. The price of food is really going to escalate, because farmers can't continue to produce food below the cost of production.
What about the proposals, Dennis, about, for example, farmers over 65 not getting subsidies in an effort to encourage farmers like Sophie, who are really struggling? I mean, she's caught between a rock and a hard place.
There's a lot of people listening on this morning, who are in receipt of their pension, and older farmers who are listening on, who would love to have a Sophie on their farm, rearing and willing to take over their farm. But the reality is that about 60% of farmers have no successor. And this is where we're facing. And this is what we've always said, like, that farming needs to deliver an income comparable to other sectors, or young people will walk away. And that's
do you welcome that idea, which is to say, once you turn 65, you can't get farm subsidies anymore, in order to nudge farmers to pass the
If there's nobody to pass it on to, Ella, what are they supposed to do? Like, if somebody is 65, 66, and they're hanging on in hope that their son, their daughter, their niece, their nephew, whoever it is, will take over the farm, but they're not ready to do it now. There's a lot of people out there this morning milking cows or finishing up milking probably at this stage, hoping that somebody within their family circle is going to take on the farm. So, like, what do? We make them hand over the farm or cease farming at the moment because there's nobody to take it on. And that's the reality that's out there.
Karen, I suppose, like, if Ursula von der Leyen phoned you in the morning, what would you do? Because I suppose what she's trying to do and the commission is saying is Pillar 2 has been used too much to top up farm income. So therefore, we want to stop that and we want to disseminate the money wider into the rural economy. That seems to be where they're going with it.
I mean, you know, I suppose we'd welcome that because, you know, a strong rural development, you know, economy is good for, you know, obviously directly the farmer payments, but also for our wider society. As Dennis mentioned, you know, food production. And I think areas where, you know, the likes of what we do in Forum Connemara and leader companies in general, you know, we want to create that, you know, that opportunity. Like, we'll say, for example, in our own company, you know, supporting the likes of Sophie. Like, I have two sons that roughly the same age as Sophie. And for me, I would love, you know, it's great to give them the opportunity to go and, you know, to go to college and to and go travelling, etc. But I suppose we want them to come back as well. And how can we support them to make sure, you know, there's issues all through the country, but particularly in our own area, for example, you know, securing the farm family, you know, housing is a problem, childcare is a problem, you know, supporting our older people, you know, so we have certainly huge challenges ahead. But, you know, we just have to, I suppose, try and work together as best we can and push and be creative and be brave and, you know, use digitisation, use our agility to try and, you know, manoeuvre through it. But it's still, I mean, it's still the uncertainty in the world in general is difficult, but even more so now.
Ruth, one thing that is very clear is that Brussels want member states to take more responsibility. They don't want necessarily to see a repeat of the farmer protests in Brussels. They want the Minister for Agriculture and Finance to take more of that flack, quite frankly. And they talk about efficiency and flexibility and targeting. They're kind of buzzwords that basically mean they have to make these hard choices themselves. Are you confident then that the more power is given to, in our case, the Department of Agriculture, that they can deliver then on all of the things that, quite frankly, this money needs to deliver on, which is food, you know, the economy of farmers, climate issues, nature crisis, all the rest. I mean, there's a multitude there of heavy lifting that this money needs to do.
There is, and it's really complex, and I think it's going to be really, really tricky for member states, and I think the oversight on this for Europe is going to be really, really tricky. And I mean, yeah, right now, I suppose they wouldn't be hugely confident. I think, you know, it's quite clear that we've had quite a one-track approach to agricultural policy in this country. You know, it's very commodity export focused, you know, scale focused. And, you know, what we really need to be thinking about is, you know, as Good Food, Good Farming were in Brussels last month looking for is, you know, just and resilient food systems. And, you know, it needs to be viable for farmers to produce food for their own community. We need to support a diversity of production and farm systems. And we need to support a diversity of business models and routes to market. I think that, you know, what we really need is to be looking at, you know, a department of food policy who will look across the dimensions of what, you know, we need our food system to deliver in terms of outcomes for health, for climate, for nature and for farm livelihoods and society.
OK, well, listen, we have 2 years now of haggling. Dennis, very briefly, I mean, it's 2 years ahead of negotiation of haggling. There's a long way to go yet. This is the opening salvo.
Yeah, I suppose the problem is, though, like with a 22.5% cut to the budget, like it's a loaves and fishes job at this stage. And I think, you know, there is going to be huge consequences. It's not just the farming community listening to us this morning. There's the consumers, and we are consumers ourselves. And I mean, there's really either two ways of funding, of keeping farmers in business, is either the consumer pays more or we have support supports from Europe. And yeah, as the supports from Europe dwindle, it's going to be up to the consumer to fill the gap, or else we just won't have farmers or food.
Okay, we're on 51551 for your texts. We're getting texts in about Sophie Bell, we heard earlier, the young farmer from Cavan. What an absolute joy to listen to that young woman farmer, Jimmy in Cork says. Her lovely voice and sound opinions will linger all day. I wish her every success. Another Carol from Kildare says, hi Ella, that young female farmer speaks so well, clear, honest and articulate. Dennis Drennan, Karen Mannion, Ruth Hegarty, thank you all so much for joining me this morning. We'll take a break.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
51551 for your texts. Dennis Drennan is staying with us. Tomorrow is Frocken Sunday, a traditional day in the year when people go up the mountains to pick frockens or bilberries. We're also heading into the start of Lunasa, the festival which marks the start of the harvest. Well, RTE One is celebrating this with a documentary called Lunasa, which will go out on Monday the 4th of August at 6:30 p.m. And one of the contributors to the programme is poet, playwright and broadcaster and Leitrim native Vincent Woods. Good morning, Vincent.
Morning. Yeah, very good to be here.
It is a lovely documentary, and there's a part of it which describes harvest as a time with long, generous days where the light hardly ends, the sun lingering into the evening.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's part of this series that failed. The Chinna, the fire festivals, Kieran O'Cuffey's labour of love around the quarter festivals of the year. And Lunas, of course, the Harvest Festival, the 1st of August, the kind of the turn into autumn, out of summer, harvest time. And traditionally, people went up to higher spots, up hills, up mountainsides, on the last Sunday of July, Bilberry Sunday, Frocken Sunday, and Garland Sunday in some places. They gathered.
Reek
Sunday, of course, absolutely. Croagh-Patrick Reek Sunday, and a link again to Puck Fair with all of this.
Why were
all
they going
these festivals?
Up? Why altitude?
I think people were, well, in some cases, I suspect young people were actually getting away from the older lot to dance and sport. But the bilberries, the frockens grow high up in acidic soil around bogland and heather. You find them, these tiny little black purple berries. They're kind of bittersweet. They were loved by the Vikings here, bilberry seeds found in Viking excavations in Dublin, used in baking. There's a Theodore Fitzgibbon had a great recipe for bilberry mousse. But on Bilberry Sunday, Frocken Sunday, young people went up the hills, gathered. And you that's reflected in Brian Friel's great play, Dancing at Lunasa, where the people, you know, the rumour of what's going on, the rituals up in the mountains.
Up dancing in the hills.
People gathered. It all goes back to Lu, the god of the harvest, god of light, god of the sun in a sense, and his battle with Cromdhu or Balor in some cases, who wanted to keep the harvest for himself as that god, and Lu fought to keep it for the people.
Dennis, is that what you were doing when you were younger? Frolicking up the mountains, picking frockens?
Unfortunately not. I'm probably too young for that tradition, but I always remember my father, and he always spoke of Frocken Sunday, and he lived on a crossroads called Gary Duff near Paulston. It's on the main Kilkenny Road, or what was originally the main road from Kilkenny to Carlow, near Paulston. And I always remember him fondly talking about Frocken Sunday and heading up to the Brown Mountain. And I had no idea what frockens were or where the Brown Mountain was, but I'm thinking I might go look on Sunday now, because the passion and the way he spoke about it, like, really inspired, like, that it was a really fond memory that he had of his childhood. So it was obviously something really special.
What was going up in them hills, Dennis?
No idea. My mother didn't live far from the Brown Mountain, so God only knows what happened back then.
It's interesting, Vincent, because it actually also, I mean, it was a big industry for World War I and World War II. Women and children across Ireland were picking these frockens, agents were buying them, and they were selling them to the UK.
Yeah, because it was, you know, believed that that frockens, that bilberries were really rich in vitamin C, that they were very good for your eyesight. So they're like this very special food that you probably pay a lot, and people pay a lot of money now for supplements.
Packed full of vitamins.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, so again, this is people knowing nature. They knew what had a particular use. This was, you know, it was the first fruit of the season as well. It was out ahead of blackberries. It was out ahead of everything else. And people, in celebrating this day as well, I think we're celebrating that arrival of harvest. In some places, people buried the first sheaf. The first sheaf, not the last, up on the hills on that day. Of course, Lunasa extended right through the month, and again on the 15th of August, in some places people climbed again, lit bonfires, and that, of course, again, like so many things, were Christianized, and that became the Feast of the Assumption. But you know, I always say, scratch a bit in Ireland. Scratch under that layer of Christianity and the old
the
order
pagans are
comes
there.
Out.
Yeah, and the fire, I mean, fire festivals, it's so much part of it, simulating the sun, presumably.
Totally, yeah. Absolutely. And again, Lu connected to Mercury, everything connected into a bigger pantheon of the gods. And again, I'm thinking people gathered not only high up, but also by rivers, by lakes, by holy wells. So it was almost this acknowledgement again of the importance of nature and our place in it. And again, how dependent we are on the sun, on the moon, because you get this harvest moon in August, and people, again, traditionally often went out to cut with their scythes, with their sickles in the moonlight. And it was believed that that harvest moon was actually very good for the crop. And a lot of people didn't dig the first potatoes until just after that harvest moon of August.
The basis of biodynamic farming, isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Dennis, you heard earlier Sophie talking, sort of lamenting the loss of people on the land, yeah. People at harvest time. There is a deep sadness really at the heart of it in farming, isn't there? The fact that it has become very solitary.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the case that even at the time to do these things and enjoy these festivals that were traditional in farming communities like that, I mean, everybody is now running faster to stand still to try and maintain an income. And that's unfortunate. Like, I mean, whereas 20 or 30 cows, we'll say 40 years ago, was a huge herd of cows and sustained a family where, you know, only one person, there was only one income households and children were educated and reared on, you know, 20 or 30 cows. Now you're looking at probably 100 cows is the bare minimum for
survival. But you'd encourage farmers to take that time out.
Absolutely. It's most important for mental health, for everything. Like when I think about the way my father spoke of Frock and Sunday, like, and the way it was a community event where everybody got together, had a day of celebration. And I mean, that's hugely important.
Yeah. And finally, Vincent, there's a lovely line from the poet John Montagu: the landscape is a manuscript. We have lost the ability to read.
That's it. And, you know, I'm heartened by the fact that more and more young people are looking back to traditions like this, are aware of it. You know, there was a gathering on the western shores of Loch Allen last year for
it's getting bigger and bigger,
Sunday.
Yeah.
And looking across to Slievenearn, where traditionally people gathered on this place called the Playbank, limestone plateau, up to 2,000 people coming in from Llangevlin, from Ballinaglera, dancing, taking off their, doffing their caps. To salute the sun with three cheers for the sun at the end of the day. It's a wonderful image. And again, I think exactly if we don't forget how to read the landscape, there's hope.
It is a beautiful documentary. Samhain is on RTE One Television and the RTE Player on Monday, August the 4th at 6:30 p.m. Vincent Woods, thank you so much. And Dennis Drennan as well, thank you very much for joining us. Now, of course, it is all about the Sam Maguire tomorrow. Each end of the country will be descending on Croke Park. The bookies say that Kerry have the edge over Donegal. But if the Donegal players have been feasting on John Graham spinach, you just never know. John is a farmer, a vegetable farmer near Raphoe. And over the last few years, he has run an honesty box, a farm shop, and sold his vegetables in Letterkenny's farmers market. And you can go and dig for your own dinner to fill a crate with vegetables. He also hosts long table dinners on his farm. Well, Dara McCullough dropped by to see why these are the hottest tickets in town. And he began with John digging potatoes for the feast.
How are the spuds this year, John? Very good, actually.
Really, yeah?
They're ready. I would say they're about a fortnight ahead of normal, you know.
That's just the heat, or
it's a combination of everything. There was enough of moisture here. We weren't suffering from drought.
And they're good and flowery, I suppose.
They're balls of flower, as we always say in a year. They're balls of flower.
No matter what they are, they're still balls of flower, right?
You'll see, you'll taste them tonight, you'll know.
Yeah, it'll be the test.
Yeah. So this evening we have the long table dinner on. So that was an idea we came up with last year. We can seat 32 people. Some of the restaurants that we supply, the chefs come out and each of them do a course. And so it's a 6-course meal.
With your produce?
As much our produce as we can, and then all other like local artisan producers that we sell their produce in the shop, their stuff will be showcased as well.
So these carrots, for example, are they on the menu tonight?
They're on the menu tonight, as well as our own potatoes and our own garlic and our own sprouting broccoli. And we also have our own beef, which is the main course is our beef, and there's just some of our own pork as well.
Yeah. And of course, you're standing here talking to me nice and relaxed.
When you're setting up and all and going through all this stress, you'd be wondering, like, why did we agree to this again? But on the night, you'll see how much people enjoy it. People really love it. The tickets sell out in like a matter of minutes.
We better look lively and get this stuff back to the yard.
Chefs are all here, the customers are on. Paul Nunn.
Who's doing the first course?
Martin Anderson doing the soup.
No soup bowls this time.
There's Martin there, is it?
Welcome to Ballyholy Farm. Yes.
A bit of madness going on here.
Hey, well, it's just great. The place full of chefs, place full of customers. Everything's great, fantastic, and the sun's out.
Tell me about the soup, because we're after digging spuds and carrots.
We make as much as we can using the local produce John has. We have a new potato, creamed leek, and a Corvine Glen hickory smoked bacon soup. We're actually serving the soup, and there's a local bakery, Bell's Kitchen. We've actually got him to make extra large dinner rolls. We've hollowed out the rolls, and we're serving the soup in the roll with the lid on top.
Nice one. Saving the washing up.
Saving the washing up, because Peter Campbell Catering gives out to me about having to wash the soup bowls after him. Yeah, using everything local. That's the secret.
The chef in charge of the beef main course was Cathal Armstrong. Cathal, how's it going?
Pretty good. Pretty good. We've got the meat under control here.
Yeah, I can. My mouth is salivating just looking at them. Yeah. I haven't even tasted anything yet.
Yeah, they're big Flintstone steaks.
Yeah, they're gorgeous looking. You know. How did you get involved in an event like this?
So I got connected with the Food Coast Donegal's great group of artisans, you know, cooking local food and focusing on the food scene in Donegal. And one of the farmers I was introduced to was John Graham, and he's right up my alley. I like that kind of food straight out of the ground, from the ground to the plate, as quick as you can. And yeah, he mentioned there was a long table. I said, well, put me in. That's my kind of scene. So
right.
Here we are.
It's possible to do high-end cuisine at the side of a farm shop?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, you just have to pick the right menu for it, and you have to work around the equipment that you got. This guy, Peter, has this great charbroiler here that we're using to cook the ribeyes on. And then I got carrots from the farm and cauliflower from the farm, and you know, I spent years living in an insane environment in the cauldron, and just happy to be in a little bit more of a relaxed environment. Cooking great food is a blast.
I'm guessing from your accent, you spent time in the States, but you're now back here in Donegal.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, I moved from hell to paradise.
Okay, all right. Well, I'll let you keep at it there. Well done. As the evening got into gear, I met some of those lucky enough to have tickets.
We wanted to come for a long time, but we can never get tickets, so we feel honoured to be able to get tickets tonight. So there we go.
They're like Oasis tickets. You have to queue and be ready to hit.
Exactly.
Click.
Glastonbury wouldn't have a patch in this, no. So there you go.
My favourite dish was definitely from the Lemon Tree, the beetroot with the beetroot ice cream. It was so tasty, it was decadent, and it was lovely showcasing the beetroot, so it was gorgeous, really enjoyed it.
Well, it's actually been on my mother's bucket list for quite a while. So as soon as she got access to the tickets, she bought 4 tickets. And so it's great fun, meeting new people. What's not to love? The drink on offer between the distillery and the local wine shop's just been fantastic.
Great.
Dara McCullough with John Graham there. Ballyholyfarmshop.com. That's the farm in near Raphoe in County Donegal. That is it for us this morning. If you're travelling to the game tomorrow, travel safely. Producer Eileen Heron on sound, Mark Dwyer, broadcast coordinator Amadine Passett-Devine. We will talk to you next week.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.